You are listening to An Introduction to the Catholic Life.
Hello there.
Buonasera.
And welcome to An Introduction to the Catholic Life. Welcome to episode 9.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have an interesting discussion today, which I'm sure all of you have your own opinion on, and hopefully we can help that today. But before we get into that, how has everyone's weekends been?
Brilliant. We've actually had the first weekend of the summer in Scotland.
Mm.
So we all spent a lot of time together, I think. Mm-hmm. We had a barbecue on Friday.
Mm-hmm. A barbecue on Friday, yeah, exactly. And then a kind of barbecue yesterday as well.
We bought those really rubbish disposable ones and managed to cook 4 burgers over 2 hours. So
yeah. And
one every half hour.
No.
4 at the same time. They just took a long time to cook. For those of you who aren't in Scotland, you might not know, but Scotland doesn't get very much sun at all. And so this is probably the first sunny day we've had this year so far.
And the last.
And the last, yeah.
We had the notion to get a barbecue at like 5 o'clock in the mm-hmm. evening when it was like nice and sunny, everyone was out in the park. And I think by the time we bit into the first burger, the sun had went down and it was about 9 o'clock.
Midges were everywhere.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But it was a good day.
It was good. Some football. Football in the park. Football in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Don't normally get that, so amazing.
And so you might also realise that Sean sounds a lot clearer this week. For the last two weeks, he's been using the old microphone, which isn't as clear as the rest of them. And so you just took it out of the box just there. And then we're drinking some water. We just had some lunch. And then he just dipped the microphone straight into the water.
Oops.
But it's okay. It sounds okay.
Yeah. The episode's not too bad now, but the whole reason I was using the old microphone was basically maybe a month ago or 2 months ago, we bought 4 brand new microphones, and within 2 weeks, I had broken one. I don't think I'm that clumsy, like, normally, but I've managed to break one microphone and today nearly break a second. But
I've started to feel a wee bit less pro-life because of your actions.
Oh, I see. What, you want to euthanise me?
Yeah.
That's light. That's
pro-death.
It's for the common good, Sean. So.
Well, there we are. And that may allude to the very topic we're going to be speaking on today, which is indeed pro-life. So we're going to be discussing a few things about the pro-life debate, where we stand on it, where it fits into the Catholic life, and many different things. But I wanted to start off on a quote by a very famous saint, who I'm sure all of you will be very familiar with, and that is James Farrell. This quote is from John Paul II, and he said, "To be actively pro-life is to contribute to the renewal of society through the promotion of the common good. It is impossible to further the common good without acknowledging and defending the right to life, upon which all of the inalienable rights of the individuals are founded and from which they develop." So very clearly from John Paul II and from many other recent saints in the Church's history, like Mother Teresa, Gianna Mola, we see that it's a very integral part of the Catholic life. And indeed, the whole foundation of Catholic social teaching is hinged upon an explicitly pro-life message, which is, you know, the Catholic social teaching is founded upon the dignity of every human person. Fundamental to the dignity of every human person is their right to life.
I don't know what you guys think, but I actually would say that people I've met who don't know anything about Catholicism, they generally know that Catholics are pro-life, though. So I think it's maybe one of those issues that is quite often associated with Catholicism. Not exclusively, but quite often Catholics are the biggest voices in this debate in society.
Yeah, certainly in the UK, I think that is the case. It's almost it's entirely synonymous, Catholicism and being pro-life, and for good reason, for that aforementioned fact that, you know, the whole social teaching of the Church is founded upon that. But one thing that quote that we started off there with always makes me think about is the fact that to be pro-life talking about that foundational point upon which the human being can develop. Being pro-life is being hopeful. And living in a society which has rejected the pro-life message, which has rejected that idea that life is good, life should be protected, life should be valued, a society that's rejected that has somewhat lost hope. And often when we look at particularly abortion statistics in the UK and Europe, indeed all over the world, and we see the scale on which abortion is happening, we see, you know, how in what large numbers we are ending the lives of the future generation, which is a real sure way of saying, yeah, we've lost hope.
I think that speaking to people in the past about their opinion on abortion, that actually comes across, that they've lost hope. And the reasons that they give for abortion as being acceptable is because there's no hope for people in certain situations. So they would say, for instance, if you don't have enough money, if you know, things like that, then there's no hope for you. Your personal situation has no hope. There's no hope for life. So the only answer is to have an abortion.
And exactly. And when you ask women who have had abortions, they never say, or they very rarely say, oh, I was in a fantastic situation and I didn't fancy it. Often it was because, in some cases, let's be honest, some women are forced into this. Others say, oh, I was in desperate situations, there was no way I could afford a child in the house, I didn't have any support. It's not particularly, as you're saying, it's not particularly hopeful reasons. In fact, there's a complete lack thereof.
We hear an awful lot about a woman's choice or a woman's right to choose, but I think there's another way to tackle the question, in that often it's not down to the mother at all, whether she keeps her child or otherwise. And I think that's true, certainly, in some of the larger countries in the world. If you look at the People's Republic of China, which until recently had the enforced one-child policy, it was very rarely the decision of a woman to make whether or not she wished to have a child, because certain wealthy families were in a position where they could pay the fine, which the government asks families to pay, should they have a second child. And guess what? Most women were not in a position to be able to afford that at all, whether they wanted to have a child or not.
Absolutely. And one thing that I wanted to flag up early, which is really central to this debate, is why are we pro-life in the first place? So it's all well and good, you know, talking about the social pressures, and indeed, you know, when you get right into the debate, these are very important. But the fundamental question is, and it's very closely related with the Catholic life, of course, it can stand on its own as well, and that is the question, why are we pro-life?
I think at the very beginning you kind of hit it in the head, Sean, though, when you said that something about that, you know, there's a life being taken, that we're quite happy to take lives. And that's it for Catholics, isn't it? That it's not a woman's right to choose. It's actually two people involved. And so one person shouldn't have the say to kill another. And for Catholics, that's the thing, because the child and the womb has a soul, an eternal soul, has a destiny in that sense, and is loved by God. And so to kill that baby for whatever reason just isn't acceptable.
Yeah. From a scientific standpoint, it is a human life, and we can see that from pretty basic biology, that is specifically a human person with human DNA, and it's alive, and for that reason it has to have human rights.
I don't like this misnomer which you often hear, that which grows in the womb is but a clump of cells. It's a very specific grouping of cells, however, that's quite different from a group of skin cells or anything else which you might find in the human person. Looking at it from the question or aspect of potentiality, that clump of cells is never going to grow to be anything other than an individual human being, never to be repeated. And so there is something entirely coherent from a scientific perspective, from a biological perspective, about the pro-life standpoint, which begins from the moment of conception.
Absolutely, and if you pick up any embryology textbook going in any university these days, you will find that, exactly as you're saying, from the moment of conception, a genetically complete human being is already present. And the argument that that is a potential life, or it could be a life, simply isn't true. And it's not true from the basic fact of dead things don't grow. And these cells, in a certain sense, we're all clumps of cells, but labelling as such doesn't really just devalue our human dignity immediately, and neither does it the entity within the womb.
That's the thing, though, is that then is unique as well. Scientifically, it's a unique being with unique DNA, and it's never going to, you know, that child will never be around again. But that whole thing about labelling is so true, because we all know Sister Rosanne Reddy, who's one of the Sisters of the Gospel of Life in Glasgow. She does a lot of good pro-life work, but she always says this in her talks, and I think we've heard her quite a few times talking about it. She's saying how this idea that it's a lump of cells. No one ever goes up to you and says, oh, when are you expecting your lump of cells? Mm-hmm. And it's this kind of labelling thing. And from a culture which is so happy to, and in fact, most people I would say probably are, at least think they're pro-choice. But yet we're in a culture which would go up to you and say, oh, how's your baby doing? And you're just, you know, I've witnessed that firsthand. But as soon as Naomi announced that she was pregnant to everyone, people come up to her in the street and everything and say, oh, when's your baby due? And, you know, they're not calling it a lump of cells. They know actually that it is a baby. But whenever it gets difficult, then it's always a lump of cells. Yeah.
It's a real struggle because you hear these arguments in it. We were talking about a different situation earlier on where people tend to do a lot of mental gymnastics to get around the point. And you'll hear this, these situations, and they'll say it's the situation because she's obviously chosen to have life. Mm-hmm. She's decided to keep the baby, so it's a baby.
So now it's a baby,
yeah. In that situation. Oh. If that baby was not going to go ahead, it would remain to be a lump of cells.
And this touches back on the fact that we need to be consistent with our giving of human rights to people. It can't be a pick and choose, because otherwise it actually undermines the whole purpose of human rights. The whole purpose of human rights is so that we all of us human beings, have a good quality of life and are respected. And if that can be undermined simply by someone saying, I have decided that this isn't a baby, then that's a very dangerous position we're in, because suddenly human rights are only given to people who we think deserve them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it. And that is what is happening, actually.
We see that, the fruits of that in Western society especially. Exactly. Yeah.
You can see this at the other end of life as well, because you're now saying, okay, well, if we can decide when and when not people deserve human rights, then, well, actually, do you know what? We can decide ourselves when we are to die. We're seeing more and more, particularly in northern and western, some parts of Western Europe, euthanasia come in, you know, the killing of old people, sometimes called mercy killings. And again, it's this kind of we're trying to take God's job out of his own hands. And this is very contrary to the Catholic life, which, as it rightly should, hails God as the ruler of life and death.
There's no surprise that disability groups and charities that work with disabled people, they rejected wholeheartedly anything to do with euthanasia, because it states that there's a certain type of life which is worth living.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, once you start to go down that line, you start to say this group of people are not worth, their lives aren't worth living.
Yeah. And that brings us very, very well on to a topic which is very closely linked, intrinsically linked to the pro-life debate, and that is the abortion of disabled children in the womb. Very similar to euthanasia, you know, it's a group of people who are being said to, oh, well, your life isn't quite worth living. That specific type of life, that specific disability, that means your life isn't worth living.
Exactly. And it's even more than that, isn't it? In the sense of saying that, you know, actually, it would have been better if you weren't alive.
Yeah.
It would have been better for you just to die, because you know, these kids who are in the womb, they're going to have your condition, be it, you know, no matter what it is. Actually, it's better for them, and it's better for their parents, and it's better for their family, and it's better for society that they just die, because look at your life. Mm-hmm. And it's horrible, actually, and that's why, like you, James, like you said, when it came, especially in this country, in the UK, to talk about euthanasia, the biggest campaigners against it were these disability groups, you know, and charities and stuff, who were saying this is going to go crazy, because the message you're sending out to people with disabilities and people who are vulnerable or depressed or feeling quite alone, or, you know, this is, it's got bad consequences.
I know. And it's this kind of slippery slope. If you start to only give human rights to people who we think should deserve them, then really they're not human rights at all. And it's a slippery slope which leads to very bad places. Rudy's already mentioned the one child policy in China, which has recently been made a two child policy, is that right? And you know, it was forced abortions for women who had two or more kids. And you're seeing it in Europe with euthanasia. And you're seeing it as well in the abortion industry, because if you look at countries like Iceland, you're actually seeing that, and this is a terrible statistic that's actually true, 100% of babies diagnosed with Down syndrome in the womb in Iceland are terminated. 100%. And in Britain, it's actually 90%. Which isn't too far off. We all know people with Down syndrome, and I'm sure nobody would say, yeah, the world would be a lot better off. Well, I hope no one would say the world would be a lot better off with no Down syndrome people in it.
There's a particular spin which has been apparent in the media's reporting of the Icelandic story. Numerous headlines said words to the effect of Iceland 100% success rate in the fight against Down syndrome, or identifying Down syndrome. This isn't what has happened in Iceland. Iceland has wiped out its Down syndrome population. That's something very, very different from identifying and perhaps doing more in terms of medical research.
It's almost like you're talking about cancer. You know, you eradicated cancer. It's that kind of success thing. Yeah. You know, it's not...
I'm sorry, but it's a headline you could have seen in Nazi Germany in the 1920s.
Yeah, no, that's true.
It's absolutely shocking, I have to say. But it's happening in our country as well. A country that would bang on about equality, you know, constantly, the equality of people, the quality of life. But then for abortion, we have a 24-week limit, which is very liberal.
Yeah, double the European average. And in fact, it's right up until the day of birth for cases of... not even definite, but suspected disability right up till the day of birth in the UK.
We are saying in our laws that there is not equality of people.
Yeah, absolutely.
In attempting to dictate ourselves whose lives are worth living, we have in fact put ourselves at the end of a cul-de-sac as well. We put our own lives in danger in so doing. And you look at the demographic squeeze in Western society, this is ever so apparent now. In the United Kingdom, in Germany, in Russia, and many other relatively developed societies, the birth rate is approximately 1.2 or 1.3 per couple. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know that's not sustainable in the long term. But of course, we needn't wonder then, if we ourselves have created such a selfish and self-centred policy, why then the aged and the disabled will be put in danger at the end of their lives. And indeed, that can count for us as well decades later on. If we give up the right to our own lives, then... we needn't wonder why that would come back to bite us at the other end.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the right to life is just so fundamental. The fact that it can be undermined in, as you're saying, developed countries is really scary. The whole fact that we have human rights is actually founded on Catholic social teaching originally. You know, it's that idea that the dignity of each human person is of inestimable value and we can't take it away.
And as a society, we've lost that philosophical underpinning to a lot of things, though. See all the time and read all the time philosophers arguing about what is the philosophical underpinnings of human dignity when you remove God. And that's an interesting discussion. How can you actually justify it, really? Like, what is it that makes humans special? How can you try to convince me that you've got any worth if I want to, you know, kill you? Like, how can you convince me that? And if there's not some sort of
underpinning, if there's no underpinning, then exactly, there's nothing to stand on.
This is something which many atheist thinkers and philosophers have actually seen to the bottom to as well. That really is what underpins Nietzschean philosophy or existentialist philosophy. If you remove God from the equation, then of course it's every man for himself. Of course it becomes the Darwinian, social Darwinian, survival of the fittest sort of scenario. Of course it does. That's quite irrational opinion to put forward if you remove God from the equation, but that's precisely the irrationality of it all. Yeah. You remove the fundamental grounding of all reason itself, and of course you're going to become an irrational society, and that's pretty much what we're seeing.
And it's this slippery slope. We take away the foundations, we take away that right to life, and we find ourselves in godforsaken territory, as we often see nowadays. But what really spurred us to want to talk about this topic was the fact that we are 50 years down the line from the implementation of the 1967 Abortion Act, which was brought in by the UK government and implemented in 1968. And it's a particularly damaging bill, as we've seen, you know, the demographics that we've already spoken about, that, you know, the 1.2 children per couple statistic and all the rest of it. It's been quite damaging for a number of reasons. But what I think it'd be good to speak about is the original pitch of that bill. There were three criteria that the government said, you know, this bill needed to stick by if it was to be introduced, and it'll be a common three criteria that many people have heard, particularly if you're in Ireland right now and you've got that referendum on abortion looming. And it's those three words: safe, legal and rare. Now, why those words are particularly telling about the whole abortion debate, I think, is held within the third one, rare. Many people who support abortion would say, oh, you know, it's a woman's right to choose, you know, just whatever, it doesn't really have much consequence, you know, it's not your decision, it's just theirs. That would seem to suggest that abortion itself doesn't have any moral consequences. It's as morally significant as getting a tattoo removed, by that logic. So why rare? I always found that interesting when they were pitching it. And, you know, you look back and you read the bills now. Safe, legal and rare. If it's morally inconsequential, then why rare?
Yeah, and if it's a truly good thing, then why not the opposite of that?
Yeah, why not encourage it as much as possible?
Why not frequent?
It's the same reason why today, you know, they still, if you go for an abortion, I'm led to believe that, you know, they won't even, they never In the training, the nurses are told, don't refer to it as a baby, don't say his, you know, he or she, they don't ever tell you really what the procedure is going to be like necessarily, and these sorts of things, because you, I think there is, we do even realise, even at the depths of, you know, this low part of society, they're still realising that there's something wrong here, and they can't really quite tell people what's going on, because it's, you know, intrinsically going to be bad for them to hear.
And particularly talking about how abortions actually take place, if many people knew the procedures, the actual procedures themselves, I mean, they would absolutely, they'd be horrified. I mean, and you don't need to look up any graphic imagery or anything like that to understand how bad they are. You know, there's kind of
textbook stuff.
Textbook stuff, and it's really terrible. You would expect it to be terrible because it is. At the end of the day, it's a procedure which has taken the life of a human being. Which as Catholics we can't stand for. You know, it's fundamentally, it's in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill.
I watched one of those videos of Planned Parenthood, which was an exposure about Planned Parenthood selling body parts of aborted fetuses. Now, there was a series of them, and I could only watch the first one, and it was just a woman sitting over dinner, eating a salad, talking about the procedure, talking about what body parts they were selling, and how they could change the procedure so that they could get the head without intact compromising it.
It turned your stomach, listen, the way they were callously speaking about it.
And it's so normalised for them. Like you said, you can sit over their dinner, having their salad, having a glass of wine, chatting away without any being phased at all with any of it.
And this is going on in a time and place when so many individuals and groups place such an emphasis on animal rights, for argument's sake.
Yeah.
A few weeks ago, I was in Edinburgh, and there was a graffiti on the wall which said words to the effect of, choose dignity, reject suffering, choose life, choose veganism. And I just thought to myself, what an astonishing example of what you might call paramorality.
Yeah.
So there's some sort of indication that dignity as a concept exists, that there is such a thing as dignity, as hope, that suffering in one way, shape or form is wrong, but it's aimed at entirely the wrong goal. I just thought it was an astonishing example of just how far we've gone down a road which we ourselves don't know where that road ends. It just struck me as being something which went beyond satire.
It's unthinkable. And Connor said earlier on, you know, when we take away when we take God out of the equation, we can end up at all these satirical almost positions where, you know, people would much rather save the dolphins or become a vegan than they would save an unborn human being in a womb. It's very sad, very, very sad. But the thing is, it's convenient because, do you know what, animal rights are a lot easier to fight for than human rights. Being vegan is a lot more easier than standing outside of an abortion clinic and praying for the women that are inside there. It's a very easy way to reassure people that yeah you're doing a good thing, you're fighting the good fight, whereas actually they're fighting for something that sadly is a non-issue when you compare it to the issue of abortion. I wanted to touch back on something that James alluded to just there, and it was that idea that in order for the abortion lobby to be successful, we need to dehumanize, they need to dehumanize the unborn child. And you can see that in the movements in the past which devalued human dignity, whether it be the slave trade or Nazi Germany. They both relied on the dehumanisation of the group of people who they wanted to oppress. So during the slave trade, black people were, I think, legally constituted as either one-third or two-thirds of a person at one stage, and that was written into law, but they were dehumanised. They weren't fully human, and so you could treat them however you like. In Nazi Germany, Jews were considered not to be human beings, and so therefore you could treat them in whichever way you like. Nowadays we have the unborn baby. People say it's not human, and therefore you can treat it however you like. You can see it's a frighteningly similar mentality, and those mentalities in the past led to really dark places. But we need to shed light on the fact that they are all human, and human equality and human rights to all is something that we need to really seriously strive for.
We're approaching the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Iron Curtain, and that was a fight in which Pope St. John Paul II was very, very heavily involved, fighting for the freedom to worship, the freedom to talk about God openly in society, and the pro-life dimension was a crucial part of that whole change in society. But I often wonder, since the collapse of the Iron Curtain in 1989, whether in fact the Iron Curtain actually just pushed itself further to the West in many ways, because we are living in supposedly free, liberal, open Western democracies, and yet we are now implementing so many of the policies which so defined the communist parties of the Soviet Union and Poland and so forth. In many ways, we've gone backwards instead of forwards in attempting to propagate and promote human rights across Europe.
It's quite popular now and quite fashionable to be a communist as a young person in Scotland. Just put that down there.
I know. I saw them on Buchanan Street actually the other week, and I had to hold myself back from trying to start an argument with them.
I mean, the amount of times you speak to people, usually kind of middle or upper class young men at university, will say, I'm a communist. Yeah. You know, like, all right, okay. Yeah. Nice.
But these are movements which don't use the family as the main point of reference in discussions of life or anything else. It is the state which is the arbiter of that which is true and that which is false. In some ways, we're falling into that trap now as well. Now imagine if you were told by Communist Party officials in Romania or in the Soviet Union that you had no right to have a child. Well, we would rightly say that that was incorrect. And yet we're perfectly willing to turn a blind eye to abortion becoming almost a sort of an industry in the United States, for example, which adversely affects certain communities more than others. It's often been said, although perhaps not often enough, that black and ethnic minority communities, for instance, are targeted by groups like Planned Parenthood. Instances of abortion occur at a much, much, much higher frequency in black and Afro-Caribbean communities in the United States than they do amongst middle-class white families. There's a reason for that. In some ways, we've almost ideologized abortion, and we've managed to do it while still pretending to ourselves that we are promoting human rights across the globe.
It's an ideology which is seriously, seriously lacking in hope, because it's one that puts the unborn child on the altar of sacrifice for human freedom, and it's a sad position to be in. But it was interesting because I was looking at quotes to start off this podcast with, and I came across quite a few from Mother Teresa. Now, Mother Teresa worked, she was a Catholic missionary nun. I'm sure just about everyone of you listening will have heard of her. She worked...
I think we've mentioned her in like 5 or 8 podcasts.
Oh well, no intro needed. But she worked with the poorest of the poor in Calcutta. But when she came over to the West to meet people like Hillary Clinton, she was asked, you know, why haven't we cured AIDS? And her answer was, the person who would have cured AIDS was probably aborted. And she actually considered one of the most important issues to fight in the world, being someone who worked with the poorest of the poor, one of the most important issues in the world to fight was abortion. And she said, you know, why are we surprised when there's wars all over the world when a mother has the right to kill her child? And the language that this is dressed up with nowadays with in the medical profession, terminations, we've already said, you know, many medical staff don't refer to, by instruction, they don't refer to the unborn baby as he or she and whatnot. You know, this dehumanisation, it's absolutely becoming overwhelming, and it's leading us to further down that slippery slope, which is not taking us to a good place.
And that question of hope, that idea of hope, is something which I always think, when we talk about abortion, as Catholics, we can really try to present that to your people. Because even though we're spent, you know, the last half hour talking about abortion and what's wrong, actually, there's hope. And even if, you know, I'm sure if everyone who listens to this podcast, even us around the table, I'm sure we probably do know, even if we don't realise it, we know people who have had abortions, probably both. We probably do.
Yeah.
Some way, know young women who have had an abortion. And we can offer them as Catholics hope as well in that position. By saying, of course, what you did was not right, and we think that's where we're trying to campaign against it, but at the same time there is hope for you because God loves you, and there's the sacrament of confession, and he wants to bring you back into his embrace in that sense. And so I think as Catholics we have that extra weapon that people often say, okay, you're not caring about the women, but it's like, well, actually we are, and in fact we have the message of eternal life. Yeah. We have that message of Christ which says, okay, no matter what you've done, okay, we put that in the past, come to him. I think that's always an important thing to
absolutely
say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we need to counteract that. You know, I mean, John Paul II often referred to, you know, this acceptance of abortion as a culture of death. We need to promote that culture of life. Bringing children into the world should be a hopeful endeavour. You know, it shouldn't be something that is scared and not spoken about or anything like that. It should be something that we're proud to promote. I wanted to share this wee story that I heard from, it was actually just a parish talk, which someone I know was giving this talk. And it's a white flower appeal. So you just go in, it's for SPUC. Go in and you just promote the work of SPUC, Society for the Protection of Unborn Children. And basically this girl went in and she gave a talk in the parish, but she kind of went off script. And when she was talking in the parish, she actually confessed, you know, to the congregation that she had had an abortion, and it was one of the worst things that ever happened to her in her life. You know, she shared that, and she shared the fact that she had lost her hope, and she was kind of feeling like kind of very, very vulnerable after this mass, having, you know, shared her own very tragic experience. But a woman came up to her after mass, and she said, "I really want to thank you for that talk, because I've actually just cancelled an abortion that I was scheduled to have in 2 weeks." And that woman went on to get counselling, and the help that she needed, and brought that child into the world, and I'm sure is much happier for it, and that child is alive. That's a life saved. Every life saved is a gift, and it's another soul's chance of living a fulfilled, happy life, and please God, we'll get to heaven.
Amen.
So intellectually, we have explored, you know, the whole abortion debate. It's a genetically complete human being. It should have the right to life, etc. And that, I hope, to all our listeners is quite crystal by now, and we've discussed a lot of that. To link this in with the Catholic life, now the thing particular about the Catholic life is it's not just about what we say, it's about what we do. And being intellectually pro-life is fantastic, and discussing with our friends and all that reasons to be pro-life is something that we all do, and it's a great thing. But also what we need to do is we need to back that up with action. There's lots of good Catholic groups that do a lot of great pro-life work. We know the Sisters of the Gospel of Life, who are based in Glasgow, and they work with women who are in crisis situations. They give them financial, spiritual help,
advice,
whatever
and
may be needed.
Yeah, counselling and everything.
Yeah, and they do fantastic work. If you need their help, Sister Roseanne Reddy, messages will give you her phone number, sorry. And other organisations as well help fight this culture of death and promote the culture of life, and that would be like the Society for Protection of Unborn Children, based in Scotland as well, and they have a sister organisation called ARCH, Abortion Recovery Care Helpline. All these people are here not because they want to stand and condemn and be angry at everyone who's had an abortion, but actually because life is a good thing. Life's a good thing. We want to help bring as much of it into the world as we can, and we want none of it to be lost to things like abortion or euthanasia, and we want to support people, and these groups want to support people.
I think that those groups, the fundamental thing is you're saying life's good, and they want to say that to people, that their life is valuable, that their life is wanted, their life is needed.
And they're great examples of how Catholics, like you said, are not just standing there wagging their finger at people saying what you're doing is wrong, because sometimes the media would like you have you believe that that's what the church is doing, saying this is terrible. But actually what they're showing is that Catholics on the ground are there to care for you, and they're not wanting to wag the finger at you at all. They're not wanting to condemn you. They want to help you as best they can, be that practically, spiritually, or in any other way.
Absolutely. So I'd like to thank you for tuning in to episode 9 of Introduction to the Catholic Life.
I just want to give some shout-outs. Is that okay?
Shout-out time. Do-do-do-do-do.
Okay, so time for some shout-outs. Before we finish, sorry. These grapes are distracting me. Father Sean Wiley, Father David Standen, both contacted us. So just to say thanks for your support. Enjoy the podcast. And I was speaking to a seminarian in Rome, Bobby Taylor, so he'd been listening as well. So just wanted to say, I don't know, keep up the good work, Bobby.
Yeah, to all of the guys in Rome, thank you for listening. And also to anyone else who's contacted us, because over them, it's been 2 months now almost, hasn't it, we've been doing this. Mm-hmm. With a few emails and a few different comments, obviously, and people liking and sharing our stuff on Facebook and on Instagram and stuff and Twitter. So just thanks very much for all your support. It means a lot to us. And remember to get in contact if you want to suggest anything we can talk about, or give us some fraternal correction or anything like that.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially if it's to James, you know, like, all like that.
So you can always, as usual, you can get us on all of our social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We've got an email address. You can listen to a previous podcast to find that out, because I can't even remember it. And as always, you can listen to us on the website or on iTunes. So please tune in to that, and we will hear from you all soon. But I'd like to toast this one to all the people in Ireland who are working against the pro-abortion referendum, which is coming up. So cheers to them, and cheers to the pro-life generation.
Cheers.